It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Ann Strainchamps. Today, it's all about cats. In this show, we usually talk about important stuff. Big ideas, new books, politics, culture. But lately, it's come to our attention that what you guys really like, what you actually can't get enough of, isn't big ideas. It's cat videos. Welcome to our first ever and hopefully only show about cats. Beginning with, you guessed it, celebrity cats. The world-famous Nya cat, the inscrutable grumpy cat, the Japanese feline sensation Maru, and of course, keyboard cat, and Henri, le chat noir.
Mon nom est Henri. Je suis un chat noir.
Henri is the creation of filmmaker Will Braden.
J'habitais une vie de luxe. Mes concierges m'emmènent.
I made the first one when I was in film school in 2006. I had an assignment to do a profile of someone, and I procrastinated way too long, and so eventually I didn't have a someone, but I had a cat and a camera, and so I decided I'd make a parody of these sort of old French black and white films that we were watching in class. And that was the genesis of Henri. He's a depressed French existential cat.
Unbelievable as it seems, 20 million people have seen Henri the Cat's videos. And Will Braden is no longer just a guy who makes cat videos. He's the curator of the annual Internet Cat Video Film Festival, held at the Walker Art Center in Minneapolis. Charles Monroe Kane talked with Will Braden. And if he sounds a little puzzled, that's because until this interview, Charles had never seen a cat video.
So you're kind of a cat video rock star, right?
Well, I would say Henri is. I'm sort of a manager of a rock star.
You're a manager of a rock star. But what's that like as the human being in this equation? Like, are you treated like a celebrity? People want your autographs and stuff?
Well, I mean, Henri has a book out, and so I do a lot of book signings. He obviously doesn't sign the books himself. No. And he doesn't travel at all. He just stays here in Seattle. For me, it's sort of like I've been at events where they're literally events honoring Henri, and I'm walking around and nobody has any idea who I am. And people sometimes get a photo with me, and I always wonder why, because I don't have the cat with me. It's like, oh, there's Denzel Washington's dentist. Like, let me get a photo. If you have to explain who the person in the photo is, yeah, you just shouldn't get a
you
photo.
You shouldn't get a photo of the autograph. Who's this guy?
No, yeah, I'm happy to be someone in the background and let the cat be famous.
The thing that I found really interesting is reading about you and your cat. This isn't even your cat.
Well, it feels like he's my cat. I see him all the time, but he actually lives with a close family member. But he's just a few minutes away from me. I was there when we got him as a kid, and he's pseudo been my cat for my whole life. So,
from watching some of those videos, he seems like I'm on my own kind of cat. Like he wants to be on his own. Yeah, definitely.
That's part of what makes the character work is that he really has this sort of imperious stare about him that you can kind of project whatever you want onto it. Once you do the French and the music and the black and white, you really buy him as the character. Whereas if you just saw the raw footage, it's just a cat sort of looking off into the distance, as they do.
Do you do this for a living? Like, do you pay the rent with this?
Yeah, it is funny because before all of this started, I was doing video work still. I was doing wedding videos and sort of local commercials and stuff like that. So I was sort of a camera for hire. So there wasn't this one big moment where I went into my cubicle drone job and slapped my resignation down on the table. That would have been a little more
take
dramatic.
This job and shove it. I'm a cat video
Yeah, I got
man
cat
now.
Money now. I'm out. No, it just was I gradually did less and less other work, and it's a living.
Now, I don't know what your friends are like, but I'm just wondering if you're going out for beers and you're sitting around like, was there a point your friends were like just started teasing you about the fact that you're like the cat guy?
No, everyone was dubious about it at first. When I first started doing less other work and saying, like, this is kind of starting to pay the bills, everyone was like, yeah, right. Well, we'll see when that wave hits the shore, you know. But it's more interesting when I meet people that I don't know. Because when people say, what do you do? What am I supposed to say? If I say, oh, I'm an author and a filmmaker. Oh, well, what have I seen anything you've done? Let me ask you this. Do you watch cats on the internet? So I can't sort of overrepresent it. So if I just say I make cat videos, people go, what?
Yeah, right. They walk away.
I actually have a business card. On one side, it has all of my info. On the other side, literally just says, I make cat videos and nothing else.
I'm curious. So you create cat videos for this film festival. And I know there are a lot of people out right now who got their ears close to the radio because they want to know what makes a good cat video.
Right.
So what makes a good cat video?
Right. Well, I can tell you as the person that is sort of making the choices of what makes the cut, there are some guidelines I found that really help your chances. The biggest one is it can't be too long. We're trying to get 100 videos in about 70, 75 minutes. So if you have a 15-minute opus, you know, with a long Martin Scorsese tracking shot of your cat, it's not going to make the cut,
okay.
No matter how great it is.
No apocalypse.
Brevity is good.
Your brevity is good.
Yeah. Another thing is try not to force your cat into something just because you think you have a great idea. Try to have the idea come from something funny your cat does or something unique about your cat. I see a lot of sort of forced, this cat doesn't want to be doing this kind of stuff. And I would say the last thing is, and this is, I think, advice for anybody that wants to go viral with anything, is try to keep the biggest reveal or the biggest laugh or the slip and fall or whatever it is right at the end of the video. Because that's when people will, in their brain, be thinking, I got to send this to so-and-so.
Got to share.
They'll love this.
What are these festivals like? I know they're huge. Like, are people cheering? Are people bringing their cats?
Yeah.
Are they hugging each other? What's it like?
Yeah, you know, what's interesting is I don't think a lot of people would be faulted for thinking that it's just a bunch of crazy cat ladies.
Exactly what I thought it was.
I know. That's what a lot of people are. But it's funny because when you think about it, this is something that appeals to a lot of different people. It's G-rated. It's very sort of fun and kind of joyous. Because it really is. I mean, what was the last time you saw a movie or went to a concert that you thought, oh, this will appeal to my 6-year-old daughter and my 60-year-old father? It just doesn't happen. But
right.
This is something like that. And the best part about it is we really encourage people to come and enjoy this, not sort of in an ironic, detached way, but just if you like cat videos, don't be ashamed to just come and enjoy it and enjoy yourself. You don't have to say, oh, I'm kind of here as a joke or whatever. It's very hard to be standing next to 10,000 other people all laughing and enjoying the same thing and feel embarrassed by it.
You know, we're talking about your success, which actually I find really fascinating. But the whole thing is completely predicated not on you, but on a cat. How do you feel about that? It's really predicated on this animal that doesn't even have a choice in it.
Well, it is funny because I have to remind myself a couple times that he doesn't understand any of this. This is all just on me. And so there's been plenty of times when I had the opportunity to do something, but I would have had to travel with him, and I just have to say no. Because even really cool opportunities, a couple big shows in LA that wanted to have me and Henri on there, but he would just hate it. And I'd be sitting on the plane and he'd be freaking out, and that's when it would hit me, like, he's not enjoying this as a cat celebrity. He doesn't know what a cat celebrity is. He would just be going, why am I on this huge, loud machine? Why am I not at home? So, and not to mention, what if he got on the stage and he was scratching at me, or, you know, he whizzed on the carpet in front of 10 million people? It would kind of ruin the mystique of the character, you know, as a philosopher. So I have to remind myself, he is just a cat. He's not actually the character.
Well, would you mind, for our listeners, I mean, public radio people own cats, I think. Would you mind saying something to our listeners, for Henri to say something to our listeners?
I mean, I would say Henri's message is probably rise up against your imperialist dictators. Free your minds. You know, he's definitely for cats' rights over human rights.
Will Braden is the creator of Henri Le Chat Noir and curator of the Walker Art Center's annual Internet Cat Video Film Festival, which, by the way, is open for submissions. You know, it's really kind of astonishing when you think that cats were wild animals not that long ago. Today, they're not just pets. They're family members, surrogate children, even therapists. And before long, they could be more. Science writer David Grimm believes cats and dogs might be on the verge of legal citizenship. Steve Paulson asked him how that's even possible.
David, there are now cat videos that get 20 million hits. How do you explain this? How did we get here?
Well, Steve, it's been a long journey. Cats, we probably domesticated, where the thinking goes, about 10,000 years ago. In fact, some of the earliest evidence for cat domestication comes from a burial in the Mediterranean island of Cyprus. Archaeologists scanning around there in the early 2000s dug under a home, and they found a skeleton of a human, and very nearby, about a foot away, decorated with seashells, was the skeleton of a cat, and they were arranged that the cat and the human appear to be looking into each other's eyes. And this is the very first evidence we have for potentially the beginnings of cat domestication. This is about 9,500 years ago.
So there's this question of whether cats were domesticated basically as pets, I mean, sort of, you know, to become family members as they are now, or were cats treated as something that were kind of useful to have around to eat the rodents, for instance?
Yeah, they were very much, I think, seen as working animals. And the idea is they actually kind of domesticated themselves, which for any cat owner is probably not a surprise that cats would do something themselves. But yeah, I think the idea early on was this was very much a co-worker relationship. You know, you kill rodents for us, you protect our grains, we'll throw you some table scraps, we won't kill you. Up until we get to ancient Egypt, where they really became very deified in the society. I think a lot of people are familiar with this idea of cats being gods.
What kinds of gods did they become in Egypt?
Well, cats actually became associated with a few very important Egyptian gods. One, Ra, the sun god. Also, Bastet, which was a goddess of fertility, also became very closely linked to the cat. Bastet, curiously enough, was thought to have 9 lives, and she appears to be playing a fiddle.
So this is where the 9 lives of cats comes from.
That's one theory, okay. For sure. Yeah, a lot of the mythology around the cat that we have today actually comes from ancient Egypt.
So cats were revered, but then in the Middle Ages in Europe, they were kind of demonized by certain church leaders. Especially, there was a Pope Gregory the Ninth. What did he have against cats?
Well, yeah, the good times certainly didn't last for cats. What we see in the Middle Ages, there was this Pope Gregory the Ninth, as you said, Steve, that lived in the 13th century. His big thing was he was really concerned about the rise of pagan religions. He basically issued this screed that said, here's how you spot heretics. They meet at night, they light candles, and also, by the way, there always is a cat present. And this cat isn't just a cat. This cat is actually an incarnation of Satan. And this is where we really see the first linking of cats with things like witchcraft, evil, Satan. And what was really unfortunate with this screed that Pope Gregory the Ninth issued is that it led to centuries of cat persecution across Europe. You saw cats being thrown into bonfires at celebrations, being hung from trees, being stoned to death so badly, in fact, that cats, it's thought, almost went extinct for a while in Europe in the Middle Ages.
Now, you say that this whole demonization of cats may be one reason why we had the Black Plague.
Yeah, that's certainly one theory. The black rats actually are the ones that actually carried the plague. And the thought was, as you had the disappearance of cats, you had no longer any cats around to be killing these black rats, and the black rats sort of bred out of control, spread disease out of control. A very hard thing to prove, but it's certainly one thing that's been suggested for why there was such a massive plague that actually wiped out up to half of Europe's population is because you had a lot of cats disappear.
So when did cats start coming back then? I mean, now, of course, we see cats everywhere, but when did they become popular?
Well, I think you start to see a rise of the cats and dogs also as pets. In the 1800s, this is when we're seeing a rise in sentimentality in places like Europe and America. People are starting to think about animal feelings. People are living in smaller houses. We used to live with our cousins and our grandparents. Now we're living in more atomic family units. We're seeing all other animals disappear from cities. You used to walk down the streets of New York and there would be horses everywhere. You'd walk around Chicago and there would be pigs and chickens. And all these animals start to disappear. This coincides with less people in the house. And what happens is it really creates this void. We have fewer people in our house. We have fewer animals around us in society. And so we really begin to latch on to cats and dogs as sort of another, sometimes the last living, loving presence in our lives. And that really, I think, helps transform them to pets. And then as the 20th century progresses, where we become even more and more isolated, and especially in the early 21st century, where we have the rise of the internet, the rise of social media, where we all go out to a cafe and a big group of friends, but we all stare at our iPhones the whole time. I think now more than ever, we have this huge emotional void in our lives. And that really transforms them, I think, from being pets to becoming true members of the family, which is what we really started to see in the last couple decades.
And then there's some question now about whether their legal standing is also changing. I mean, whether, you know, they're not simply animals that we own, but something else.
That's right. This is really fascinating what's been happening in the courts, especially in the U.S. As pets have really transformed into family members, we're starting to see some really interesting cases. People have probably heard about pet custody cases where people are fighting over the cat or dog. And actually, another interesting case involving a cat happened in the late 1990s in Washington, D.C., where a couple of roommates were actually arguing over the custody of their cat. One of the roommates had gotten the cat, and the other roommate argued he was a much better guardian for the cat and he should have the cat instead. And the judge agreed, said that this person was a better owner and it would be in the best interests of the cat to actually live with this other roommate. So you're starting to have judges talk about pets like they talk about children in custody cases.
So there must be a different legal status then if this happens. And I know there's been this move in some circles to grant dogs and cats in particular, the status of personhood.
There is. There definitely has been. And that's very controversial. Cats and dogs are still property, but some people have said, clearly we don't treat them like property. We really treat them like children to a large extent. So you have seen some groups that have argued that these pets deserve something more than property status, that they deserve something like personhood.
But what does that actually mean, to grant a cat or a dog personhood?
Well, it could mean a couple of things. It could mean just more jail time, more prison time for people that abuse or kill cats and dogs. It also could mean mandatory veterinary care, kind of like we have mandatory medical care for our children, that if you own a cat or a dog, that you should make sure that they are healthy. And if you're not, then maybe some sort of pet protective services which show up at your house and take your pet away if you didn't take good care of your pet. So, a lot of these things sound a little extreme, but that's in some of the conversation about just what rights should we grant to our pets.
Well, I mean, I would think there would be all kinds of actually very difficult issues. I mean, would it be okay to own a pet? Does that become comparable to slavery then?
That's exactly right. I mean, some people have said if cats and dogs are people, you can't buy them or sell them because you can't buy or sell people. Or you couldn't even spay or neuter them because that would be a violation of their rights. So when we start talking about things like rights, when we start talking about things like personhood, we get into some really interesting but also very tricky waters.
Well, if you really push this, I mean, you could make the argument that we are on the verge of a new civil rights movement, a civil rights movement for our pets. I mean, it raises the question of, is this really comparable in some ways to previous civil rights movements? Granting more legal status, for instance, to African Americans or to women?
Yeah, this is a really hot button issue because some people in the animal rights community will say, absolutely. First we had civil rights and women's rights, and now it's time for animal rights. But then you have people on the other side say, this is very offensive. How dare you talk about rights for cats and dogs in the same sentence that you talk about rights for African Americans or rights for women? And so you have very passionate voices on both sides of this debate.
Now you're a cat guy yourself, right?
I am. I've got two cats at home, Jasper and Jezebel. My wife and I have two kids, but we have two cats, and everybody's a member of the family. We had the cats first. The kids came along a few years later, and obviously we prioritize our human children, but we still do treat our cats like members of the family. We still dote on them and care about them, and if they get sick, we rush them off to the vet clinic and we take pictures of them. And the scientific part of me really wonders, how did we get to this place, and why are we investing so much emotional energy in what essentially was a wild animal just a few thousand years ago? So I'm really fascinated by this relationship we have with our pets.
Have you ever posted videos of your own cats on YouTube?
more than I care to recount.
David Grimm is the author of Citizen Canine, Our Evolving Relationship with Cats and Dogs. He talked with Steve Paulson. Now, long before we were posting pictures and videos of our cats online, people have been celebrating cats in song. Throughout this show, we've been playing some of the cat-themed music of our own times, but this kind of thing has a long history. as our resident sound and history nerd Craig Ely is here to tell us.
And there really is a great weird history to composers trying to incorporate cats into music. Rossini, for example, famously wrote a cat duet where he asked sopranos to stand on stage and sing the word meow repeatedly.
Funny.
It was much more common, though, for composers to just use instruments to try to represent an animal's voice. Think of Peter and the Wolf, where the cat is played by the fuzzy, warm sounds of the clarinet. But this wasn't good enough for some people. They wanted the voices of actual cats. So get this. Even though one was never built, there's this 17th century notion of a cat piano.
A cat piano.
Again, we think only in theory. Here's how it worked. Instead of a hammer hitting strings, the cat piano strikes a nail into a cat's tail who's trapped in a cage inside the piano. There's more than one cat, obviously, so you can get multiple pitches of painful shrieks.
That's like extreme keyboard cat.
Yeah, it's really, really extreme. But now we don't need a cat piano because we can record the voices of actual cats. So what you can do is get a cat's voice, sample it, and then match that sample to actual notes on a keyboard.
Do people or cats actually listen to this?
Well, that's the interesting part. All of the examples I've given so far are about what we might call human music. But recently, some researchers here in Madison started asking a different question. What kind of music would cats want to listen to?
Assuming cats would want to listen to music?
Well, they might. They might. But what they did is they started thinking about cat physiology. How do cats vocalize? What can cats hear? They meow at a range that's about an octave higher than our voices, so they had to adjust for pitch. Their heartbeat, their breathing, everything is at a slightly different rhythm. And this composer, David T.A., tried to take all this into account, and he wrote this music for cats, took it into a lab, and they played it for cats, and guess what?
Did the cats like it?
They loved it. They loved it. They started purring, they were rubbing their heads on the speakers, they had an incredibly positive response. So I'm going to play some of that right now. If you're out there listening, grab your cat, put him or her right by the speaker, and have a listen to this. T.A. is also working on music tuned to other species. He's done some work with monkeys, I believe. So maybe the next time you're in the record store, you'll see the feline section right there next to electronica.
I can see it now. Cat music studios run by fat cats. Craig Ely is our digital producer. Coming up, bigger cats. Why the world's tigers need your help. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. It's all about cats today. And have you noticed that all the cat people we've talked to so far are men? I mean, whatever happened to the stereotype of the cat lady? Are they being supplanted by all these hip young cat guys? Seriously, there's a long and slightly strange association of cats and women. Writer Ben Hoffman has been having some fun with that in a story he's writing about a woman big cat biologist on the dating scene.
I work in big cat conservation, which always gives men the idea I am a sexy person. I am not. So far as I can see, there is nothing so carnal about saving the Asiatic cheetah. No, I tell men on first dates. I'm a woman with a desk job. I work in maps and spreadsheets. Do you find data sexy? Men do not find data sexy. I knew this. I always have. But I've also relearned the hard way, just to be sure. For example, I meet for an exploratory gelato with a tiny man who works in copy editing. The copy editor's profile did not mention that he is 5'2", but this is apparent now, in the flesh, whenever we are standing. So we stick to sitting. Sitting, he is a normal height. What's that like, I wonder, your whole life trying to stick to sitting? Isn't sitting what kills you? Right away, he wants to know about the big cats. Have I been to the jungle? Saved a lion up close and personal? I let him down as best I can. I tell him I work in a cubicle just like him. I'd never been out in the wild, never snatched a panther from the jaws of a poacher's trap, never mended a tiger's wounds. Not sexy. He takes a consolatory bite of gelato. One thing I have noticed about men is that when their sexual fantasies come to ruin, they turn invariably to anger or sarcasm. Big cats are great and all, he says, but what about small cats? Don't you care about small cats? What about medium cats? What about the polar bears? I'm on a date with a copy editor who does not understand the concept of niches. I say to him, what about a walk while we eat our gelato? It's so nice out. Let's stand. Let's stroll. The week after my date with the copy editor, I meet a securities trader at a small bar on the Upper East Side where Irish men control access to the jukebox. The securities trader only has to see me to know I am not the woman he was imagining from my profile. I have never wrestled a lion to safety, never dragged my body provocatively through mud, never thrown a net over a bad man with a gun. So, the securities trader says, what's the deal with big cats? I sip my drink. I ask, what do you mean, what's the deal with big cats? Like, tell me about a big endangered cat. Make me care for him. Or, hell, her. I tell him about the wild snow leopard, how there are only 200 left in Afghanistan. Don't they have bigger fish to fry over there? He asks. Just kidding. He tugs on his tie. But why are they special? Give me a fact. Give me three facts. I tell him how the wild snow leopards have 3-foot tails, how they spend most of their life alone, how Chinese men grind up their bones for traditional medicine, how they can leap 30 feet at a time when they're attacking prey, boars, gazelles, mice. 30 feet, he says. Hell, can we train him to attack Al-Qaeda? Can you imagine? Osama coming out of his cave and whammo. They're dying, I tell him. He snorts. Hell, if we're down to worrying about the cats in Afghanistan, we may have to give Bush some sort of medal. I feel that I deserve some sort of medal.
That's an excerpt from a work in progress by Ben Hoffman. He's a 2015 Stegner Fellow at Stanford University and a creative writing fellow at the University of Wisconsin. And we had sound design by Joe Hartke. So let's meet a real big cat expert. J.A. Mills is one of the foremost conservationists working to save tigers. 20 years ago, when she was an undercover international wildlife investigator, she stumbled on a horrific trade in tiger farming. In a new memoir called The Blood of the Tiger, she tells the story of the battle to save one of the world's most endangered species. Steve Paulson talked with her.
Judy, can you tell me about the first time you ever saw a tiger in the wild?
The first time I saw a tiger in the wild was in India, and I had been taken there by a good friend of mine into a tiger reserve called Ranthambore. And we were looking for tigers and finally saw one in the tall grass, crouched down on a hill looking down at some sambar deer who were feeding in a pond below. And The thing that was fascinating to me about this animal was that it reminded me of my house cats, except that it was so enormously bigger. And it was so majestic. I think it's really important to see them in their natural habitat and to see them hunt. I saw this female take down a deer to feed her three awaiting cubs.
What was that like to see a tiger take down a deer?
Well, I don't think I took a breath until it was all over, but it did happen very quickly. Here is this animal of this absolutely bright orange, black, and stark white, very carefully sniffing out her strategy and then in a moment leaping toward her prey and running at, I don't even know how fast she was running, but before we knew it, she was on this deer and had it by the neck and mercifully choked the life out of it very quickly. And as she walked away, I was so sorry to see her go, and I knew she had to feed her cubs. But more than anything, I wanted to protect her. I wanted to protect her and her kind because I had never seen such magnificence.
Now, you said that the tigers you saw actually reminded you of your house cats. It's just kind of hard to believe. I mean, how much of a resemblance did you see?
Well, the thing is I was with my friend and another person, another Indian man, both of them very, very experienced with tigers, and they wanted to leave because they thought she was going to settle in for a nap. But I had noticed the way her whiskers were going forward, the way my cat's whiskers go forward when they are playing with a cat and mouse and wanting to pounce on it. And I said, no, we shouldn't go. Something's going to happen here. And afterward, they asked me, how did you, someone who's never seen a tiger before, know what was going to happen? And I said, because that's what my cats do. And so the gestures were the same. The looks were so similar, except the paws, of course, were the size of my head.
Right. Now, you say that you became bewitched into what has been called the cult of the tiger. What does it mean to fall under the spell of the tiger?
Well, I have seen it happen to others. I think anyone who has seen a tiger in the wild becomes beguiled to either help them or to capture that essence. And I think that there are many people who want to own that essence. And that is part of what's driving what I think is the biggest threat to the survival of wild tigers today.
Now, I know for you, the story really goes back to the early 1990s when you were an investigator with the World Wildlife Fund, and you went undercover in China. What did you find there?
Yes, I went to China for the first time in 1991 to verify rumors that the government there was farming bears for the bile in their gallbladders and actually milking them of their bile while they were still living. And I will never forget the moment when my government minder turned to me and said that China intended to farm not just bears, but a long list of other species like cows and pigs. And as it turned out, they were indeed farming bears by the thousands and milking them of their bile. But I didn't see that. And in order to keep me from seeing that, my hosts took me to a mink farm that happened to have a handful of tigers. And it was there that staff showed me a handwritten ledger that they were filling up with orders for tiger bone.
Wait, so this was a tiger farm. I mean, they were raising tigers to then harvest their body parts?
Yes, this was the handful of tigers that spawned the tiger farming industry in China today, which now has between 5,000 and 6,000 tigers for the making of tiger bone wine and tiger skin home decor.
You'll have to explain this. So why would people want wine made out of tiger bone?
Initially, tiger farming was started because China was using tiger bone in traditional Chinese medicines that were being manufactured on a large scale. That stopped in 1993. The traditional Chinese medicine industry globally made a decision many years ago that they didn't want to use tiger bone because they didn't want to be blamed for the extinction of wild tigers. This was a strategic business decision. They wanted to have Chinese medicine practiced alongside Western medicine around the world, and they knew that wasn't going to happen if they continued to consume the body parts of these beloved animals.
So what happened then?
So what happened is the farms kept on growing and the investors began creating wineries where tiger skeletons were steeping in wine. And this is no longer about health. This is about wealth. It became apparent that this could be a multi-billion dollar industry.
So the Chinese government knows this is happening.
The Chinese government actually supported it. China's wildlife protection law actually calls for the farming and consumption of a long list of endangered species, including tigers. Now, there are Chinese within China who are now working within the National People's Congress to try to take out the farming and consumption mandate, but that hasn't happened yet. So in the meantime, the ministry that's in charge of protecting wildlife is also the ministry that has invested in these farms and even paid for some of the wineries to be built.
Now, this sounds truly horrible. I mean, the idea of basically killing tigers, harvesting their body parts. But I would think maybe the silver lining would be if these tigers are being bred in captivity, at least they're not being hunted in the wild. Maybe tigers could survive in the wild. Is that happening?
That's sort of the intuitive conclusion. But unfortunately, the problem with tiger farming is that it stimulates demand, and that in turn stimulates poaching of wild tigers because the products from wild tigers are considered superior, more prestigious, and exponentially more valuable. Think of tiger bone wine from farms as maybe wine at the supermarket, and wine made from the bones of wild tigers as the 1945 Chateau Mouton Rothschild that sold at Christie's a few years back for more than $100,000. There are some people who are investing in products from wild tigers as they would invest in gold or rare art. They are basically hoping to bank on extinction.
And then there are some notorious stories of how tigers are used for social status. I mean, there's this one story of a man who was a businessman, I believe, who actually had a tiger electrocuted at a banquet, and then he ate the tiger.
Yes, while his friends were watching. But there is this culture in China where my Chinese friends use this phrase. They eat everything with its back to the sun except airplanes and tables. And the more exotic the animal, the more prestige to the person eating or serving it. But also it's thought to be more healthful as well. And this is a tradition that comes down from China's emperors. The emperors had their famous banquets that included bear paw, moose nose, tiger meat, and a long list of other things that most of us have never heard of.
Now, I'm assuming there are people in China, conservationists, who think this is appalling. I mean, that this whole system that you're describing, are there efforts to crack down on these tiger farms?
Polls repeatedly show that a majority of people in China want the ban on tiger products to stay in place. And they find it an embarrassment to their beloved country. They're media savvy. They know what the world is saying about it, and they don't want to have the blood of the last tigers on their hands. So there's that going on. And then there are conservationists and others, attorneys and animal welfare advocates, all Chinese, who are working together behind the scenes to try to change the law. But unfortunately, the National People's Congress go-to ministry on this issue is the State Forestry Administration, and that is also the ministry that is supporting tiger farming.
I have to say, I mean, listening to it, it sounds fairly hopeless. I mean, if we're talking about the future prospects of tigers in the wild.
Well, it is hopeless if people don't start talking about it, because what has happened is that this particular ministry with a vested interest in tiger farming has actually been threatening conservationists and governments alike. I know for a fact that NGOs working on this issue, foreign NGOs working on this issue in China, have been threatened with being kicked out of the country. And it's had a chilling effect such that people aren't talking about it. This is one of the reasons why I wrote the book. And this is one of the reasons why I am telling everyone that they can have a part in changing this. And they can do that by talking about it, to anyone, one-on-one, on Facebook, on Twitter, More importantly, letting elected government representatives know that we would like the United States government to take a strong stance on this. We have to make it okay to talk about it.
Now, very few of our listeners will ever see a wild tiger. What do we lose if tigers go extinct?
Well, some people believe there's an existence value. I personally, yes, I've seen one in the wild, but I love the idea that this majestic animal exists, that it's out there. These tigers, this species, is the living embodiment of centuries of human lore. And if you look around, look at all the college teams that have tigers as mascots. Look at all the products that are sold with the image of tiger, or the tiger brand name, or Tiger Woods. This is a creature that we have admired throughout time. And think about that iconic creature in a feedlot. And the other issue, too, is that wild tigers are very important in terms of the health of our planet. One of my Indian friends says that tigers keep forests standing, because when there are tigers in a forest, that forest is protected, the trees are left standing, and those trees are the lungs of our planet. And many people have said that if we can't save wild tigers, what can we save? Can we even save ourselves? But I do want to emphasize that if people, just regular people, start speaking up, there's hope. There is hope. It's not too late, but we have to act now.
At the last count, there were just 3,000 tigers left in the wild. J.A. Mills is a tiger conservationist and author of Blood of the Tiger. Steve Paulson talked with her. Coming up, we've been talking about cats this hour, but we saved a little time for dogs. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. This hour, we've been talking about cats, but I have to tell you, I'm a dog person. I mean, cats, they don't even like us. Dogs, though. Now, dogs have been our best friends for 36,000 years. That's loyalty. And now, anthropologist Pat Shipman says, if it weren't for dogs, we humans might not even be here. So to understand why, you have to go back 40,000 years or so. That's when early modern humans began moving into the territory of another advanced hunter-gatherer species, Neanderthals. And not too long after we showed up, those Neanderthals went extinct. There have been a lot of theories about why. Pat, did we just out-hunt them?
Yes, in a sense, I think that's the simple answer. We were better at it than they were. But the question is, why were we better at it? We didn't have some technological innovation like a machine gun.
Maybe we had sharper spears.
What I think we had is dogs. I don't want people to think, oh, they had retrievers or poodles or
corgis.
Afghan hounds or corgis. Yeah, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about probably a barely domesticated but special group descended from wolves. They were a little smaller on average than the wolves at the time, but they were still very big animals. I mean, at least German shepherd-sized.
But it sounds like the wolves would have been natural competitors or even predators of humans. Why didn't the wolves just eat the humans?
I'm sure they did if they could. But in some way, humans and dogs formed a kind of cooperative alliance It benefited both of them hugely. Wolves hunt in packs. They already cooperate with other animals in their pack. They're very skilled at this. They are very adept hunters, and they will separate out an animal, even a very large one, isolate it, surround it, charge it, wear it out, harass it until it's exhausted. Now, a wolf would then have to go in and pull the animal down. That's when they get hurt. If, however, at that point, humans come in, and humans have bows and arrows and spears with spear throwers, they could kill the animal at a distance, which is a big advantage, saves risk to the wolves. But because they're working with the wolves, they get the benefit of the attributes wolves or wolf dogs have that we don't. They're faster than we are. They can track by sense of smell. They can track by hearing. They have weapons, if you want to think of their teeth as weapons, attached to their face. I would not give a human any chance of taking down even a small deer with their teeth, right?
So, even in Wisconsin, which is big hunting territory, I haven't seen anybody take down a deer with their teeth yet.
No, much less a mammoth or a bison.
Well, so it sounds like what you're saying is that this was a really natural alliance, that the wolf dogs could hunt the mammoths down, exhaust them to the point that the early humans could come in and finish them off. Were there any other advantages the wolf dogs gave the humans?
Oh, yes. Wolf dogs, I am presuming, but it's certainly true of wolves and dogs today, are extremely alert, and they are very territorial. They defend their kill. This means if you've done something like killed a 1,000, a 2,000-pound animal, maybe even a 5,000 or 6,000-pound animal, you don't have to cut it up and run away with a piece before somebody comes and takes it off you. Hanging around carcasses is a dangerous thing to do.
Really? It was risky once they'd brought down a mammoth to chop it up?
Absolutely. If you think of the African savanna today, a lion brings down a large antelope. Almost immediately, other scavengers are there trying to take pieces of it, trying to take over the whole carcass.
So that was the case in Northern Europe? Would, I don't know, saber-toothed tigers be lurking in the wings to take down the early humans and steal all the mammoth meat?
There were saber-toothed cats, a form of leopard, cave lions, cave hyenas, wolverines. So all of those would be wanting to get a piece of this carcass that you'd just gone through the labor of tracking and killing. But if you're there with dogs, you can camp right next to the kill because you've got a built-in defense to help you protect that carcass.
So I know a lot of your evidence comes from a prehistoric site in the Czech Republic.
Yes.
Like a kind of mass mammoth kill. Can you describe it? I mean, what do you see there and how does it kind of change the way we see this early human history?
Well, it certainly changed it for me. I've been to several of these sites. They are usually up on a low slope of a mountain. They're near water. They're near rivers. Some of them, and this is the most wonderful stuff, have huts built out of mammoth bone. Some of them, and this is the most wonderful stuff, have huts built out of mammoth bones.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, it's just amazing.
What do they look
now,
like?
They look kind of like squat tents. And undoubtedly, they were covered in hides. They have hearths inside. Some of them have areas where people made tools, stone tools, areas where people seemed to be cooking.
So these are really early settlements. And then how many dead mammoths?
In some of them, it's several hundred. Wow. In some of them, it's at least a few hundred. And before this time, if there was one or two mammoths in an archaeological site, it was remarkable, kind of notable. The idea that there would be these mass piles of bones, even if you allow that it happened over time, maybe happened once a year for a number of years, it's still pretty astounding, and it's a big improvement in hunting ability.
Hmm. So, Pat, you're painting this picture of the way humans and these early wolf dogs would have worked together, kind of formed a hunting alliance. Why didn't the Neanderthals do the same thing? They were hunting and predators in exactly the same area. They presumably might have actually seen early humans and wolf dogs working together.
I suspect they did see each other, although we never will know that for sure. One reason may simply be intellectual. That is, as you know, if you've ever worked with animals, some people are really good at reading animals and some people don't understand, you know, the dogs jumping up and down and barking at the door, and they don't know what that means. So it may be Neanderthals didn't have the ability to empathize the way modern humans did. Another possibility, which is testable and therefore I think a really interesting idea, is this. We humans are the only primate that has highly visible white sclera to our eyes. That's the what you call the white of your eye. What this does for you, I mean, it's clearly a biological genetic adaptation, and it makes the direction in which you are looking very evident to another individual who is looking at you, working with you, or whatever. It means if you're hunting, you don't have to shout and point and say, I'm going to run around this way, you go the other way, which kind of blows your cover. But it means you can coordinate, you can hunt more sensibly, more efficiently, because you can communicate.
Well, Pat, you argue that this dog-human alliance we've been talking about not only wiped out the Neanderthals, dogs and humans together proved to be kind of unbeatable, kind of like the original invasive species.
I think as an invasive predator, we were. And it strikes me as naive that people don't think they are an invasive species. We have moved out of Africa into every habitat, every continent, nearly every island in the world. And it all starts with going into Eurasia and developing this cooperative arrangement with dogs. And since then, we have moved around the world, taking over place after place after place. And at the time this was first happening, there were no domestic animals. I don't think the idea of domestication had ever occurred to anybody. So you have to see this as happening almost a little accidentally, probably with somebody picking up a wolf pup. And most of the time, the wolf pup would grow up and would bite somebody, and that would be the end of the wolf pup. But then, you know, there might be some that weren't quite so aggressive, or that were a little better at communicating with humans, or that saw they might get something out of this deal if they didn't bite the humans.
Is this kind of what you call the Jagger principle?
Yes, out of I can't get no satisfaction. That is, you can't always get what you want, but if you try sometimes, you might get what you need. And so maybe wolves didn't want to become dogs, but it proved very helpful to them and to us.
Pat Shipman is the author of The Invaders, How Humans and Their Dogs Drove Neanderthals to Extinction. That's it for the conversation about cats and dogs, but don't forget to subscribe to our podcast. That way you'll never miss another hour. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. This week we say goodbye to producer Sarah Nix. She's heading to sister station WNYC for more adventures in public broadcasting. We'll miss her bright, shining presence, her luminous smile, her talent and drive and voice, and we wish her all good fortune. This week's production team includes Charles Monroe Kane, Doug Gordon, Raymond Tangakar, Craig Ely, and Joe Hartke. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. I'm Ann Strainchamps, and thanks to you for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.